Intrepid Explorers, a horrible geography book read by Vanna Vance, by Anita Gennari. Special, Don't Tell Me We're Lost Again. Illustrated by Mike Phillips. Introduction. Geography can be a pain in the neck, especially if you nod off in your geography lesson and your head's at an awkward angle. Picture the scene. 1 minute you're sitting at your desk listening to your teacher's voice droning drearily on. Today's lesson is all about flocculation. Hands up if you know what I'm talking about. Roughly translated, flocculation is the tricky technical term for the way soil forms into clumps. Just the sort of earth-shatteringly boring fact geography teachers love. The next thing you know, you're happily snoozing away and you're having a fantastic dream. Get this. You're a world-famous explorer just back from your latest trailblazing trip. You've climbed a brand new freaky peak, unknown to geography, and the reporters are going wild. I name this freaky peak after me! Good choice. The world is your oyster. Anything is now possible. Fame and fortune beckon. But before all this attention goes to your head, you wake up with a nasty start. Your teacher's shrill words bring you back down to earth with a bump and a horrible crick in your neck. Wake up, Hopkins! You pain in the neck! Why is everyone leaning over? People have been exploring for centuries, risking their lives in far-flung places that no one's ever set foot in before. Some have gone mad, turned bad, or dropped dead from a dreadful disease. Many others have ended up lost. Hopelessly lost. So why on earth did they do it? The truth is that lots of them were in it for the money. They wanted to open up the world for trade and make lots of lovely lolly. Others wanted to claim new lands to live in or spread their religious ideas. But many were horrible geographers and scientists. They simply wanted to see the world and fill in the gaps on the maps. Of course, it takes real guts to be an explorer, but if you're not brave enough to be one just yet, don't despair. The good news about horrible geography is that you can follow in the footsteps of famous explorers without having to leave home. So why not settle back in a comfy sofa, grab yourself a snack and a tin of pop, and get ready to head off on the trip of a lifetime. In Intrepid Explorers, you will dice with death as you sail the world's stormiest seas, brave blinding blizzards to reach the perishing poles, risk your life on a raging river on a wild goose chase for gold, meet the not-so-intrepid explorer who didn't actually like traveling. This is geography like never before, and it's horribly exciting. But be warned, some of the traveler's tales in this book contain spine-chilling details of disease, disaster, and death. And they're all true, unfortunately. Luckily, you'll have budding explorer Miles to keep you company on your travels. Still keen to be off? Well, good luck and have a good trip. Is this the right way up? Miles. Great! We're lost again. Intrepid Ancient Explorers. A very long time ago, about 3.5 million years before your geography teacher was born, our ape-like ancestors came down from the trees and began to walk upright. You could say they learned to stand on their own 2 feet. Haha. Meet the first intrepid explorers. What's up? My feet are killing me. Early humans were as curious about the big wide world as little kids in a sweet shop. But they also needed to keep moving to survive. They traveled long distances to hunt for food, find shelter, and steer clear of the gruesome glaciers that covered the earth. Of course, they didn't realize they were actually exploring. After all, they had no idea where on earth they were going. No one had seen these places before, and there weren't any handy maps to help them. They just had to follow their noses. Are we there yet? But oddly, the real story of exploration began thousands of years ago when people started to settle down. Perhaps all that staying in one place gave them itchy feet. They set off to find new lands to live in and new goods to trade. Luckily for horrible geographers, some of them left records of their journey so we know roughly where they went. Fancy a quick trip to ancient Egypt? The intrepid Egyptians. In around 3,500 BC, the awesome ancient Egyptians built the first sailing boats. They were made from papyrus, smashed up reeds, and had square sails for when it was windy, and oars for when it was not. These boats were brilliant for sailing trips on the River Nile. Later, the Egyptians built ships out of tougher timber for exploring the big, wide world. Destination, Punt. There was one place in particular which the Egyptians loved to visit. It was called Punt, and legend said it was the land of the gods. The streets of Punt weren't just paved with gold. Oh no, Punt was crammed full of precious ebony, a type of dark wood, ivory, baboons, leopards, myrrh, and frankincense. That smelly stuff burned in Egyptian temples. No wonder intrepid Egyptian explorers couldn't wait to get there, even though the round trip took over a year through shark-infested waters. In 1492 BC, the ruler of Egypt, Queen Hatshepsut, had a brilliant idea. She was having a posh new tomb built for herself, and it needed decorating. And what better to use than the riches of Punt? Of course, the queen couldn't go herself. She was far too busy ruling Egypt. Instead, she sent a fleet of 5 ships and 250 sailors to search for the legendary land. But pinpointing Punt wasn't all plain sailing. You see, since the last voyage there, 500 years before, its precise location had been forgotten, and it was two grueling years before they finally found it again. Luckily, the sailors brought back boatloads of priceless treasure, and the queen was as pleased as Punch. Sorry, Punch. So pleased, in fact, that she had the walls of her tomb decorated with scenes from the epic voyage. Never was the like brought back to any ruler since the world began. Punt, a shopper's paradise. Shop till you drop in a lovely land of Punt. For the best gold, silver, and ivory in the known world. Looking for the perfect present? Special offer on leopard and panther skins. Customers have said, you won't find ebony like it anywhere. You can't beat their baboons. Hurry while stocks last. Egyptian Tourist Board, 2000 BC. No, unfortunately, we can't show you a map because no one knows where Punt Valley was. It might have been in Arabia or Ethiopia. Then again, it might not. Sorry. That probably means another shopping trip. The globe-trotting Greeks. The ancient Greeks were real clever clogs. They were always dreaming up brilliant new theories to explain how the world went round. For instance, they guessed the Earth spun on its axis and moved around the sun. But it wasn't until the 17th century that anyone believed them. If I say I believe you, can I go and play? They worked out that the Earth was round when everyone else thought it was flat. Yep, people really believed if you went too far one way, you'd plummet off the edge.
I'm just taking the dog for a walk.
They calculated the size of the Earth within a few hundred kilometers or so, long before anyone else did. Pretty impressive, eh? Of course, the ancient Greeks also had some very strange ideas about geography. For example, they sailed happily around the Mediterranean Sea, fighting wars and exploring foreign countries. And they knew that the Great Western Sea, that's the Atlantic Ocean to you and me, lay beyond the Med. But would they sail into the Western Sea itself? No way. They were too bloomin' scared. It was too wild and stormy, they said, and full of terrible sea monsters who liked eating sailors for lunch. So there. Earth-shattering fact. The way into the Western Sea lay through a narrow channel of water wedged between two towering pillars of rock. But it hadn't always been like this. According to legend, the great Greek hero Heracles had to perform a series of superhuman tasks set for him by the gods. Setting off on one of his amazing adventures, he found his way out of the Med blocked by gigantic rocks. This didn't stop Heracles. He simply ripped the rocks up with his bare hands and forced a passage through. Then he plonked the rocks down on either side to guard the Med. The Greeks called them the Pillars of Heracles after our hero. We now call the passage the Straits of Gibraltar. Are you sure you don't want to go round? It needed a horribly hardy explorer to follow in Heracles' footsteps. Someone who wasn't scared stiff of sailing between the perilous pillars and out into the unknown, luckily. The ancient Greeks had just the man for the job. Are you ready to meet him? Rebel geography's traveler's tales. Pytheas, 4th century BC, nationality Greek. Pytheas was born in Marseille, France. Though in those days Marseille was called Massalia and was part of ancient Greece. Marseilles was a bustling port and perhaps was seeing all those ships that gave Pytheas a taste for travel. No one knows much about Pytheas' life or his family or exactly when he lived, but we do know he was a genius at geography and astronomy, so he must have gone to school. Not again, he always gets it right. And around 330 BC, Pytheas made an astonishing voyage to the very edge of the known world. At least that was his story, and he was sticking to it. Here's a map of the route, he said. He took Pytheas' route. 5. Turning south again. He crossed 1. With 2 or 3 ships, plucky Pytheas left Marseille on the journey of a lifetime. 2. He sailed out between the perilous Pillars of Heracles and into the wild western sea. Pillars of Heracles. 3. Then he headed north around the west coast of Europe until he reached Britain. Then he sailed all the way around it. 5. Turning south again, he crossed the Irish Sea. Then it was time to head for home, sweet home. Tall tales are true stories. Even though Pytheas was the first Greek ever to explore that far north, no hero's welcome greeted him when he finally arrived home, and no fame or fortune either. Why? Well, nobody believed a word Pytheas said. They scoffed at his stories and accused him of telling a pack of lies. Here's what one of his critics said when he'd stopped sniggering. Any man who was told such great falsehoods about the known regions would hardly, I imagine, be able to tell the truth about places that are not known to anybody. How on earth could Pyr Pytheas convince them he was telling the truth? He decided to write down everything he'd seen and called this book Description of the Ocean. But that didn't do the trick. Sadly, no copies exist today, but Polybius, another Greek, read it, and this is what he thought. Pytheas says that the seas around Thule are covered in wobbly jellyfish. Very fishy. He should have had his eyes tested before he left Greece. He also says that, in the far north, the sun shines all night in summer but doesn't rise in winter at all. Now that really is going too far. Clearly, Polybius thought Pytheas was a frightful fibber and didn't believe a word he had written. But incredibly, it turned out that Pytheas had been telling the truth all along. Notable geographers now know Pytheas was right, although he probably didn't see any actual jellyfish. In winter, the sea around Iceland, Thule, is covered in clear round blobs of pancake ice that could look like jellyfish from a distance. As for the sun, he was right again. Pytheas was describing the midnight sun. In the far north, in summer it's daylight all the time, and in winter it's permanently dark. What happens is this. During the year, the Earth orbits, circles round the sun. It also tilts over at an angle on its axis. This means that the far north is tilted away from the sun in winter and towards it in summer. Got all that? Of course, all of this was discovered far too late for Pytheas. He spent the rest of his life trying desperately to prove he was right. Fortunately, the intrepid explorers in the next section didn't have that particular problem. No, instead they had a rather rocky road to pass. Meandering monks. Thousands of years ago, Europe and Asia were linked by ancient roads. Merchants traveled vast distances along them to buy and sell luxury goods. The most famous road of all was called the Old Silk Road, though it was actually made up of several different routes across Asia and the Middle East into Europe. It was the way that precious silk from China reached to Europe. Teacher teaser. Is your teacher an old smoothie, or is she always losing the thread? Put up your hand, smile your silkiest smile, and ask her this harmless-sounding question. Please, miss, where does silk come from? A. It grows on silk trees. B. It's spun by silk moth bugs. C. It's made in a silk factory. Answer B. Silk is made from silk moth cocoons. They're cases which silk moth bugs hide in when they change from caterpillars into adult moths. Long ago, silk was all the rage. Rich ancient Romans couldn't get enough of the shiny stuff which was brought along the old Silk Road from China. But they hadn't a clue how silk was actually made. For thousands of years, the crafty Chinese kept silk making top secret. After all, silk was big business, and they didn't want anyone else nabbing a share. And the Silk Road wasn't just useful for shifting silk. It was also a brilliant way for intrepid explorers to see more of the world. Bet your teacher didn't know all that. A long and winding road. The old Silk Road wasn't a nice paved road like the ones you get today. This rocky route led through monstrous mountains, bone-dry deserts, and plummeting river ravines. Worse still, it was guarded by bloodthirsty bandits who thought nothing of murdering merchants and other unwary travelers and stealing their money and goods. Someone's coming, let's go shopping. I love shopping. So why on earth did a mild-mannered monk from China decide to follow this risky road? You're about to find out. Horrible Geography Traveler's Tales. Zhuang Zeng, AD 602 to 664. Nationality, Chinese. Some people think that Xuan Zang was the greatest Chinese explorer ever. He was also a brilliant student, and all his teachers reckoned he'd go far. Though perhaps not as far as India, where he headed in AD 629. It was actually his big brother who suggested the treacherous trip. But Xuan Zang was keen to find out more about his Buddhist faith. Buddhism began in India in the 6th century BC. He wanted to bring some holy books home to translate from Sanskrit, an ancient Indian language, into Chinese. Little did he think it would be 15 long years before he saw his home again. Earth-shattering fact. Xuan Zang was following in the footsteps of another meandering monk called Fa Xian, AD 370. He set off for India in AD 399. When he got back to China, he wrote a thrilling book about his travels. He didn't want to write it at first. He was worried about setting a bad example. He said, "If I were to tell what has happened to me, then people of unstable mind might be tempted to take the same risks, reckless of their personal safety. For they would argue that I came back safe and sound. So these foolish persons would set about jeopardizing their lives in lands impossible to explore, in which only 1 in 10,000 men could hope to come out of alive." But even these wise words of warning didn't stop hardy Xuan Zang. Almost at once, disaster struck. First, Xuan Zang had to sneak out of China because he didn't have the emperor's permission to leave. In those days, you needed the emperor's say-so to do just about anything. Then he headed west along the old Silk Road. Unfortunately, the guide he hired to lead him across the gruesome Gobi Desert, deserted him. There was nothing but sand for miles and miles, and Xuan Zang soon got hopelessly lost. "Ooh, this looks familiar." "It all looks familiar. It's a desert." All he could do was ply on, alone except for his trusty old horse. Then things went from bad to worse. Xuan Zang lost his water bag and nearly died of thirst. Then he wished his brother had kept his big mouth shut. But just as he hit rock bottom, Xuan Zang had a stroke of luck. A local king took pity on him and sent the miserable monk on with another guide and a load of goodies for the journey. Eventually, Xuan Zang reached India, where he spent the next 13 years. Like Fa Xian before him, he visited masses of Buddhist monasteries and holy sites, learned Sanskrit and Buddhist philosophy, I told you he was brainy, and collected loads of precious manuscripts to take back to China. Sometime in AD 633, Xuan Zang headed north to start the long journey home. But if he thought it would be a dawdle compared to his journey there, he was wrong. Horribly wrong. If he'd kept a secret diary, it might have looked something like this. "My Secret Diary, by Xuan Zang, not to be read by the Emperor. Sometime in AD 633. What a disaster! I reached the river Indus safely. So far, so good. But a storm blew up and almost capsized our little boat, and 50 of my best manuscripts and all the rare seeds I'd collected fell into the wretched river, never to be seen again. What's more, I've been given a pesky elephant to ride across the mountains. Apparently it's a great honor, but I'm not so sure. It's an ugly-looking brute with a nasty slint in its eyes, and it never stops eating. I only wish it had drowned instead of my lovely books. Later in AD 633. I didn't mean it, sob about the elephant. If only I could take it back. Guess what? It's only gone and drowned, and it's all my fault. A few days ago, we were attacked by bandits. What a bunch. Not content with pinching our money, they wanted to throw me into the river as a sacrifice to the gods. I thought I was a goner. I really did. But then I heard an enormous splash right behind me. The elephant was so freaked out it panicked and jumped in the river. Oh dear, where's my hanky? Homeward bound. Intrepid Swan Zeng finally reached China in AD 645. He'd traveled over 12,000 kilometers, a staggering feat for the time. He brought back copies of hundreds of holy books, he had the lost ones copied again, and other souvenirs of his trip. In fact, he had so much luggage it took 20 horses to carry it all. The emperor gave Swan Zeng a hero's welcome, he'd forgiven him for giving him the slip, and ordered him to write an official account of his amazing travels. As if Swan Zeng hadn't got enough to do translating all those books. Our next brave adventure didn't set out to become an intrepid explorer. It was all the idea of his dear old dad. But, like Hardy Swan Zeng, he got to know the old Silk Road very well indeed. Plucky Marco Polo. In 1271, young Marco Polo set out on the journey of a lifetime. Instead of having to go to school, lucky Marco got to go to far-flung China and back. How cool is that? Verbal Geography Traveler's Tales. Marco Polo, 1254 to 1324. Nationality, Italian. Marco's dad was a wealthy merchant, and when Marco was a lad, he left him with his mother and sailed off to Constantinople, now Istanbul, in Turkey. Marco didn't see him again for 9 years. Think of all that pocket money he must have missed. In those days, Marco's hometown of Venice was a rich and busy port. Marco must have watched the ships come and go, hoping for a postcard from his distant dad. Constantinople, Turkey, 1261. Dear son, the journey was fine and I got here safely. Sorry you couldn't come. Business is booming. I've already sold a load of jewels and made loads of lovely dosh. Tomorrow I'm off to China, so I'll write again when I get there. Now you be a good boy for your mother, and don't forget to go to school. See you soon. Love from Dad. XXX. P.S. I'll give you your pocket money when I get back. When Marco was about 16 years old, his mom died and his dad came home. But he didn't stay for long. Soon he was off on his travels again, only this time he took young Marco along for the ride. A dreadful journey. In China, Marco's dad had made friends with the great ruler, Kublai Khan. The Khan told him to come back soon and bring him some presents. But not any old presses, like pairs of socks or bubble bath that your dear old granny gives you for Christmas. No, the crafty Khan wanted 100 priests to do magic tricks and some oil from a holy lamp burning in Jerusalem. Luckily, the Polos had friends in high places. In 1271, they traveled to Jerusalem to pick up the oil, and the Pope sent them some priests. Okay, there were only 2 priests, not the 100 the Khan had wanted, and even they soon scarpered. But now the journey to China could begin in earnest. The Polos' plan was to follow the Silk Road for most of its length through Central Asia and into the Far East. No one had ever done this before. It was far too risky. The journey was appalling. First, Marco fell ill and had to stay in bed for a year. Then, as soon as he recovered, they climbed the perilous Pamir Mountains. But worse was to come. It was too risky to travel alone, so they hitched a lift with a passing caravan across the desperate Gobi Desert. No, not the sort of caravan you go on holiday in today. This caravan was made up of hundreds of camels or donkeys and carried goods like silk. The desert was said to be haunted, and at night they heard ghostly voices and noises like beating drums. Spooky or what? A horrible geographer would say, haunted? Pah! What a load of codswallop. The sounds I heard were made by desert rocks shrinking in the cold night air after they'd expanded in the baking daytime heat. Then again, ahog, what's that noise? I'm out of here. China at last. Finally, in 1275, the plucky Polos reached China. They were given a warm welcome by Kublai Khan, though he was a bit miffed about the missing priests. Their journey had taken 3.5 years, and they'd covered some 6,000 kilometers. Did Marco mind? Not a bit. He thought China was brilliant, and he didn't have time to be homesick. He stayed in Kublai Khan's posh palace and learned to speak the local language. Kublai Khan liked Marco so much he gave him the job of exploring his empire and bringing back news of what he'd seen. It was a perfect job for Marco. For the next 17 years, while his dad was busy with his business, Marco traveled thousands of kilometers and saw many strange and wonderful things. His favorite place was the fabulous city of Kinsai in the east of China. Its name meant the City of Heaven. Marco described it as a rich and busy place, crisscrossed with bridges and canals. Besides, it was perfect for parties, which were held on 2 islands in the middle of the lake. How heavenly is that? Turn that noise down. Voyage to Venice. All good things come to an end, and in 1292 the Polos headed for home. This time they chose a shortcut, sailing around India instead of going overland. They set off in January in a Chinese junk, that junk is in ship, not a load of rubbish, as part of a fleet of 13 ships and 600 courtiers. You see, a local princess was going to Persia to get married, and the Khan asked the Polos to escort her. But the voyage went from bad to worse. Some of the ships were wrecked on rocks, and lots of passengers drowned or died from deadly diseases. The Polos were lucky to escape with their lives, but at least the princess reached Persia safely. When the Polos finally reached Venice in 1295, most of their friends and relations had given them up for dead. So you can imagine what a stir their arrival caused, especially when they cut open the seams of their strange Chinese clothes to reveal a small fortune and jewels stuffed inside. Marco's memoirs. But our Marco wasn't the sort of person to settle down and put his feet up. In 1298, he went off to fight the Genoese, but was captured and thrown in prison. Today we climbed a snow-capped mountain. It was hard to breathe and I got a blister. As luck would have it, he shared his cramped prison cell with a writer called Rusticello. To pass the days, Marco told Rusticello his incredible life story, and Rusticello wrote it down in a book. People from Genoa. The cities of Venice and Genoa went to war over who controlled the best trade routes. The book was called The Book of Sir Marco Polo the Venetian Concerning the Kingdoms and Marvels of the East. What a mouthful. Even so, it quickly became a bestseller. Readers couldn't get enough of Marco's amazing adventures. It was just one teeny hitch. Some of his adventures were so amazing that people thought Marco must have made them up. It didn't help that Rusticello was used to writing novels about love and all that slushy stuff. He thought a book full of facts would be boring, so he exaggerated things a bit. For example, instead of writing, "Today we climbed a snow-capped mountain, it was hard to breathe and I got a blister," he might have written something mushy like, "This fine morn we traversed a wondrous peak, with its delicate dusting of elfin light. My heart sang with wonderment and my feet danced with delight." See what I mean? Marco's super sightseeing quiz. So had all the sightseeing gone to Marco's head, or was he telling the truth all along? Here are five strange sights he said he'd seen on his travels. Try this quick quiz to find out if they're far-fetched falsehoods or terrific truths. 1. Black stones that burned like wood. True or false? 2. People with long, thick tails and dog's heads. True or false? 3. A white cloth that couldn't catch fire. True or false? 4. A nut as big as your head and covered in hair. True or false? 5. A giant bird as big as an elephant. True or false? Answers 1. True. The burning stones were coal, which was used as fuel to heat bath water. In China, Marco noted, people actually enjoyed having baths. Yes, I know it's hard to believe. 2. False. This was the sort of tall tale early European explorers loved making up. For good measure, there's also a picture in Marco's book of a one-legged giant, which used its massive foot as a giant sunshade. Unbelievable. Oi, hop it. 3. True. The white cloth was asbestos. It's found in rocks and is crushed up to form fibers for making cloth and ropes. It was once used in buildings to stop fire spreading, but it's horribly dangerous if you breathe in its dust. 4. True. This tough nut was a coconut, which Marco saw in Southeast Asia. His report said the flesh was delicious to eat and the milk tasted like wine. 5. True. Well, almost. What Marco probably saw was an enormous elephant bird. It lived on the island of Madagascar.